Driver man, he made a light, but the mammy ain't his wife. Chopping cotton, don't be slow. Better finish out your row. Keep a moving with that plow. Driver man will show you how. Get to work and root that stump. Driver man will make you jump. Better make your hammer ring. Driver man will start to swing. Ain't but two things on my mind. Driver man and quitting time. And root that stump. Driver man will make you jump. Better make your hammer ring. Driver man will start to swing. Ain't but two things on my mind. Driver man and quitting time. Driver man the kind of boss. Ride a man and lead a horse. When his cat or nine tail fly, you'll be happy just to die. Run away and you'll be found by his big old red bone hound. Paddy Roller bring you back, make you sorry you is black. Driver man he made a light, but a mammy ain't his wife. Ain't but two things on my mind. Driver man and quitting time.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Axis, Sacramento, and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this program, we're listening to a debate on Iran's nuclear ambitions. The panelists debate how the world should respond to Iran's nuclear program. Topics include the U.S. and Israeli positions in the Middle East, the consequences of launching a war against Iran, and Iran's influence in the region. And as we join the debate, we're listening to Amos Yadin speak with an Israeli accent about the threat of Iran to Israel.
Our grandparents in Europe 70 years ago, in their wildest dream, never imagined that Hitler intended to do exactly what he has said. I suggest that we take this current Iranian threat very, very seriously. Why? Because Iran has a cruel and radical regime, both regarding internal and external issues. They hang 16 years old gays on cranes publicly. They torture their own citizens and kill them in prison. You know the Canadian photographer who was arrested, tortured, raped, and killed in Iranian prison. They tampered with election result and cracked down on the opposition. Iran is also number one sponsor of state global terror. And for many years, they do exercise terror all over the world. In the 80s, in Beirut, they bombed through Hezbollah, the U.S. embassy. They have killed more than 200 Marine soldiers in the Marine barracks in Beirut. The Israeli embassy in the 19th in Buenos Aires, as well as the Jewish community center in Buenos Aires. And what they are doing today in Syria, supporting Assad, killing more than 30,000 people of his own citizens. This is the Iranians. They back every negative regime in the world. And imagine Iran possesses nuclear weapons. Will this be passed on to terrorists, just as the best Iranian weapons have made their way to Hezbollah? Hezbollah is the only terror organization in the world with ballistic missiles and UAV drones, bombers. Why is there not Iranian nuclear weapons? But this is not only the terror aspect. A nuclear Iran will be the end of NPT as we know it. And the Middle East will become even worse neighborhood. Saudi Arabia, they really care. They're concerned about the nuclear Iran, more than Israel. They will go to Pakistan the next day. They already paid for the bomb. They only have to bring it back home to their Chinese missiles. Egypt, Turkey, Iraq, every country who believed to be a regional superpower will go nuclear. Nuclear balance that will include many participants is not stable. And if it's just Israel against Iran, the main concept of MAD, mutual assured destruction, that basically stable the Cold World war is not there anymore because there is no communication between Iran and Israel. We are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. At that time, the Soviet Union has an embassy in Washington, D.C. Bobby Kennedy, the brother of the president, went to Dobrynin, the ambassador, in the Soviet embassy in D.C., and they closed a deal how to de-escalate a war that was about to have a nuclear war. There is no Iranian embassy in Israel. There is no red line between the prime minister's office and the supreme leader. The world must stop Iran. This is not an Israeli problem. The Iranian regime is stand against everything and every value we stand for. Freedom, human rights, rule of law, women's rights, everything. Last word. If you believe to the international press and David Singer's new books about covert campaigns, I am the only one in the world who had taken part in three counter-proliferation operations. Two were very successful and spared the world from nuclear weapons in the hands of cruel, bloody 30 dictators. The third counter-proliferation campaign, the international community must take care of. Lest the barrel of gun, and this time a nuclear gun, will look at all of us squarely in the face. Thank you.
Well, there you see on display the discipline of an IDF officer who always completes his mission, regardless of the casualties. Fareed Zakaria, you're up next. Final opening statement.
Thank you so much. I really understand the position of the opposing team. I understand the fear, I understand the danger, I understand the challenge. Let me put this in some historical perspective. After the Cold War, the United States was the only country in the world with nuclear weapons. And then the Soviet Union acquired a nuclear weapon. And there were many people who felt, many very serious people, that this was an absolute calamity and that the only recourse the United States had was a preemptive war against Russia, against the Soviet Union. This was a position not held by wacky warmongers. Bertrand Russell, the pacifist philosopher, argued in favor of that. Harold Nicholson, the cool, unsentimental British diplomat, argued in favor of that. But a man like Dwight Eisenhower understood that rollback, a strategy of preemptive war, would have huge costs and undergo huge consequences. And so he opted instead for a strategy called deterrence and containment. Keep the Soviet Union in a box, put pressure on them so that they found it difficult to operate, and maintain the deterrence that says to them, if you try to do something, you yourself will be annihilated. Now remember, the Soviet Union at the time was regarded as a wild, crazy, revolutionary power bent on global revolution. Remember that Stalin had just sacrificed tens of millions of his people in World War II in the Eastern Front, something that was unfathomable to Western statesmen. They were routinely called irrational, crazy, wide-eyed, messianic, all the things you've heard about Iran. But we learned that the proper course of action was not rollback and a preemptive war, but containment and deterrence. Then we watched this again in China. John Kennedy feared that if China went nuclear, 25 countries would go nuclear. Well, China did go nuclear. And Mao was truly crazy. Mao openly talked about the need for a nuclear war. He said it would cause sacrifices, but it would be educational. And he said half the world will be destroyed, but the other half will be socialist. Now that's a crazier, more messianic comment than anything the Iranian mullahs have ever said. And yet, what we learned was that Mao could be contained and deterred. And then, as Vali mentioned, we watched this in the country I grew up in India. India and Pakistan fought a war every 15 years after independence. They fought three wars in 30 years. And then they got nuclear weapons. And in the last 40 years, they haven't fought a war since. Now, every time you will, of course, see tensions and you will see crises like the Cuban Missile Crisis, because these powers are in conflict with one another. But what's extraordinary is that during the Cold War, despite this intense geopolitical rivalry, which would have told you, all history would have suggested that the United States and Soviet Union would have gone to war with one another, they didn't because of nuclear weapons, because they were deterred, because of the fear of what it would mean. Margaret Thatcher understood this. In 1989, she gave a speech standing with Mikhail Gorbachev, and she said, "You and I, Mr. Secretary General, know that conventional weapons have never deterred war in Europe, but nuclear weapons have done so for 40 years, she said in 1989. Make that 70 years. North Korea, when it went nuclear, we were told all of Asia was going to go nuclear. Japan would go nuclear. South Korea would go nuclear. You could understand why. South Korea is still in a state of active arms. It's at war with North Korea. And yet that hasn't happened. South Korea hasn't gone nuclear. Japan hasn't gone nuclear. What the lesson of North Korea has been, if you're a third-rate dysfunctional country that manages to acquire a couple of crude nuclear devices, you remain a third-world dysfunctional country with a couple of crude nuclear devices. Power does not flow from the barrel of crude nuclear weapons. It flows from your GDP, from your innovation, from your technological prowess. And so we come to Israel, and we come to the challenge that Iran places there. And what I would argue is that the Iranians, as Vali has pointed out, are cool, calculating, shrewd, far more so in their rhetoric and in their actions, certainly in their actions, than any of the regimes we are talking about. They will be deterred. They will be deterred by Israel's 200 to 500 nuclear weapons. Remember, Israel has many on submarines, so that they have second strike capacity. They will be deterred by America's vast arsenal of nuclear weapons. And recall, they don't have any yet. We're talking about a hypothetical situation. And yet what we are talking about is a war in the Middle East where we would go and strike a regime preemptively. And what would happen? The regime would gain support at home. Every regime that has ever been attacked by foreigners preemptively has the effect of rallying people around that regime. We would be able to destroy part of the infrastructure, but they would be able to rebuild it very quickly. Israel's own estimates are that they would delay the program by 2 years. You would radicalize the Middle East and turn the mullahs and this regime into a much more popular force in the Middle East than it is now. Meanwhile, we have a containment strategy and a deterrence strategy. We have enormous pressure on them. The sanctions have been crippling their economy. They have not been able to develop a nuclear weapon. The Israeli intelligence that I have received in my 10 years as a journalist, every year for the last 10 years I have been told that Iran is 1 year away from getting a nuclear bomb. Either Israeli intelligence is very bad, or we have been very good at deterring and containing Iran.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Well, there's a professional broadcaster for you. 1 second to spare. Well done, Fareed. Well, look, there's so much that we need to discuss, from proliferation to deterrence. But what I think is on the mind of many people, gentlemen, in this room tonight is what's happened in the last number of weeks, the conflict between Israel and Gaza. And Vali Nasser, let's have you begin this. I mean, you've argued in a sense that Iran is seeking to acquire a nuclear device to dominate the Arab world, not destroy Israel. Yet as we heard from General Yadlin, those very missiles, those very long-range missiles that were fired for the first time by Hamas and Islamic Jihad on Jerusalem and on Tel Aviv were proudly provided by Iran. So why is General Yadlin wrong about the intent of destruction, and why are you right about the impetus towards domination?
Well, first of all, Iran and Israel have been in a low-level warfare with one another over a number of decades. General Yadlin referred to the back and forth over what happened in South Lebanon with the bombing and then the retaliations that Iran did in Argentina. There have been attacks on Israel here and there. And currently, as we're speaking, there are cyber attack operations on Iran, as well as also assassination of their scientists. They're also hitting back. But launching nuclear weapon is a whole different order of magnitude in terms of escalation, particularly against a country which has several hundred nuclear warheads with much more accurate ability to deliver them. And as Fareed said, with a second strike capability off of submarines, Iran is in no way in a position to be able to take Israel on at that level. Now, of course, Iran would brandish these missiles very proudly. It wants to change the conversation in the Middle East from Syria and itself to the Arab-Israeli issue. It wants to also tell the Arabs that it's providing ammunition to the Palestinians to stand up to Israel. It has, in the past week, it has got a lot of ground in the Arab world because of these two things. Because the limelight has shifted from them and what they're doing in Syria to the Arab-Israeli issue, and also because it's seen as the only government in the region that is providing material support to the Palestinians. Again, it's cold calculation about what would promote their position in the region.
Charles, it sounds rational, cold, calculated, moving forward to shift attention away from what's happening in Syria. Why don't you buy that analysis?
This argument that Iran is acting purely from nationalist motives, cold and calculating, simply makes no sense in relation to Israel. Iran and Israel were allies, friends, until the revolution. There's nothing intrinsic about Iranian national interest that drives it to want to destroy Israel. It is precisely the ideology of the mullahs. It is precisely the theology of the mullahs. It is precisely the idea that the revolution, as Ayatollah Khomeini explained, the revolution in Iran was the harbinger, the beginning, the spark for the return of the 12th Mahdi, the restoration of the caliphate, and the restoration of Islam's place in the world. And in order to achieve that, as they have been saying for the last year, for example, the destruction of Israel is the beginning of the redemption of humanity. Is that nationalism speaking? Is that national interest speaking? The other side is trying to pretend that somehow the Iranian regime is cold and calculating and nationalist. Then why is it risking everything by supplying arms to Hezbollah and to Hamas? How does that promote the Iranian national interest to involve itself in the civil war in Syria, where they are becoming hated by the Sunni Arabs because they are arming and protecting and even sending revolutionary guards into Syria to kill, imprison, and to torture Sunni Muslims trying to achieve freedom in Syria? No, this is a highly ideologically driven regime, and at the top of its ideological and theological list is the annihilation of Israel. And our opponents are saying, oh, it's rhetoric, it's stuff, this is a nation only interested in its own national interest. It's Charles, plainly the opposite.
Let's have Fareed come back on this critical point of what the most recent conflict between Gaza and Israel says.
So two points. Let me answer Charles's question first. The reason the Iranians espouse the Palestinian cause so vociferously is because this is a Shiite Persian regime that is trying to have dominance in the Middle East. How do you do that with a bunch of Arabs? By appropriating their most important cause. If you go to the streets of Cairo, which I have done many times, what is striking is that when you talk to shopkeepers, the photograph they have in the shop is of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, a Shiite Persian, and you ask them, why do you have that photograph? And they say, well, because he supports the Palestinians. The Iranian regime very cannily understands that by appropriating the cores of the Arab street, they are in effect outwitting the Arab regimes themselves. They are saying to the Arab street, your governments are too scared of Washington to support the Palestinians fully. We will support them. And it gives them enormous street credibility. And by the way, it is what makes Arab countries very scared of publicly opposing Iran's rise to power. To your question, what does the Gaza incursion tell us? The Gaza incursion tells us one thing very clearly, particularly if you look at the reaction of Egypt and Turkey. There is now a new Middle East, and Israel is the superpower in that Middle East. The Egyptians, under a new government, we were told, were going to be different. They were Islamists. They were ideological. You know, these guys, you know, Muslims are crazy, and then you put one of them in power like that, and you know what's going to happen. Well, guess what he did? He followed the Mubarak policy, which is basically to try to broker a deal between Hamas and Israel. And why did he do that? Because Israel's defense budget today is larger than that of all its neighbors put together. That doesn't even begin to get into the technological advantages it has, the qualitative advantages. It has the enormous advantage of being the only country in the Middle East that has sophisticated nuclear weapons on sophisticated delivery systems. And so when confronting that, yes, the Turks will make very fine speeches in favor of the Palestinians, and the Egyptians will shed crocodile tears, but none of them will do anything because, if I may say it in a word, they are deterred. If Israel did not believe in deterrence, why has it gone through the enormous expense of building a nuclear arsenal? It's presumably to deter its enemies, not to use it.
Amos, let's bring that direct point to you, because some people have commented that what the conflict between Israel and Gaza suggests is, in fact, that Israel needs some deterrence on its military action, its range of military action, to force it to a negotiating table to find a solution for negotiation, not through conflict. How do you respond to that line of argument?
I think we have to go back to Iran. I don't know what we are doing in Gaza right now, because we're speaking about Iran. And basically, the argument that the Cold War deterrence principles are going to work in the Middle East are wrong. Because just listen to Rafsanjani. You know who is Rafsanjani? He was the president of Iran. And what he has said, that Israel is a one-bomb country, very tiny, very small, and the proud Islamic nation can absorb 3 to 4 bombs. Is that deterrence? No, it's not. And you know, when the Americans and the Soviets were doing deterrence calculations, both of them have lived in this world. Then they want to continue to live in this world. We have a business with people who think about the second world, a second life. They invented the suicide bombers. They sent kids to open field mines in the war with Iraq. These people are rational, but it's not our rational. It's different. They have to call somebody over there, and I'm very, very worried about the way they are making their decisions.
Okay, let's spend one more moment on this before moving on to the question of proliferation, because that's a big one. But, Vali, you've written a series of books on Iran. It's a country from which you were born. Why is Yadlin wrong to think that there is this irrational, messianic force, maybe not amongst the Iranian people, but amongst the elite and the leadership who could make the decision of whether to engage in a nuclear conflict or not?
Well, the fact that people are willing to die for a cause is not unique to Muslims. You know, during World War II, you had Japanese kamikazes do it. Suicide bombing is the poor man's missile system. And it's been proven very effective. And that's the reason it's being used. Secondly, rulers always can manipulate the popular beliefs of foot soldiers to get them to sacrifice themselves for a greater cause. It's not unique to Iran. It's happened all over the world. And not only in Iran, across the Muslim world, the foot soldier who's willing to commit suicide for a cause can believe in anything, but the generals don't believe in that. The Iranian leaders are old men. They didn't get to that age by actually believing in suicide bombing. They didn't carry it. Not one of them carried it against the Shah's regime. Not one of them has sent his own sons to carry out the suicide regimes. Yes, of course, General Yadlin is right in the fact that the morality and ethics of this regime are abhorrent, and they use, obviously, poor, uneducated, fanatical kids to achieve their strategic objectives. But, you know, there is no evidence that Iranian rulers actually make their calculations on the basis of wishing to expedite their own departure to the next world.
Very good.
Let's move on to the theme of nuclear proliferation, because it's a key one. And to do that, over the last week or so, we've caught up with a few international policy thinkers to get their reflections on this debate, and we're going to bring them to you in the form of video clips now. The first of these was Senator George Mitchell, who we spoke to in Washington, D.C. earlier this week. He's the former U.S. Senate Majority Leader, but more importantly, he was Barack Obama's U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace until 2011. Let's listen to that clip, and then I'm going to have Charles react.
Thank you, Rudyard, and good evening. The debate on this subject has tended to focus on the threat to Israel from a nuclear-armed Iran. That's a serious concern which I share, and I'm sure it will be discussed this evening. There's another aspect of the subject that I think deserves discussion as well, and that's the threat to the nuclear non-proliferation regime, or stated more simply, the danger of the rapid spread of nuclear weapons to many countries. The United States led the world into the nuclear age, and ever since has also led the effort to restrain the spread of these highly destructive weapons, with some success. In the half century since the first atomic bomb was exploded over the desert in New Mexico, 9 countries have come to possess nuclear weapons. But the number of countries with the capability to possess those weapons is many times more than 9. Those countries which have voluntarily refrained from developing nuclear weapons, one of which, of course, is Canada, have relied instead on the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and on American leadership. If Iran gets a nuclear weapon, that could change. It could trigger an arms race in the Middle East as several countries there move quickly to get their weapon. And it's already a highly volatile and very dangerous place. Right now, Israelis and Palestinians are dying. The ancient hostility between Persians and Arabs remains high, as does the internal conflict between Sunni and Shia Muslims, which has gone on since the founding of Islam.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room, you can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.